Okay, so my name is Tom Berlijn. I'm a graduate student at Stonehoff University, and I'm doing my PhD work actually at the Brookhaven International Lab. And I want to acknowledge my collaborators, my advisor, Wei Ku, and his former graduate student, Dmitry Goya. And I want to acknowledge the funding. Okay. So this is the outline of my talk. First, I want to set up the approach that I'm taking to study disordered systems, which I call supersaw approximation, which is a good name. And then in the main part of my talk, I want to discuss the two methods that I developed together with Wei to facilitate this approach. And at the very end of my talk, I want to show some results. For this compound sodium docobaltate and copper doped zinc oxide. So yeah, I discussed the physics at the very end, but these two compounds will also be used as illustration throughout my talk. So first, the introduction. I should say what kind of disorder I'll be able to tackle with my method. So I won't be able to study these kinds of disorders, like glasses or liquids or something like that, or some kind of topological defect like that. Instead, I will today focus on a more simpler kind of disorder, where there's still some kind of underlying regular lattice present. So typically substitutions, interstitials, and vacancies are the kind of impurities that I'm studying. And the goal is to calculate the average Green's function of the disordered system from first principles. And in the community, there are roughly two ways of doing this, indirectly and directly. So let me first say something about this indirect method. The general idea is to replace the difficult to calculate disordered system with some kind of effective medium that restores the translational symmetry. So, for example, this effective medium in the virtual crystal approximation is the virtual crystal, which is just an average potential over the impurities. And since this potential is the same at each site, Bloch theorem holds again, so it's nice to calculate, but this kind of virtual crystal cannot scatter electrons. And if you're interested in that, then this is not a good way to go. Then there's also the famous coherent potential approximation. This theory treats the disorder self-consistently, and it's apparently mathematically proven to be the best single-site theory for studying disorder. But for example, such a theory will not be able to handle clusters of impurities that are bigger than the single site. And those kind of cluster scatterings might be important. For example, states that live here at the edge of a band, they might be very sensitive to scattering from these kind of clusters. Or another situation you can imagine is that you have some kind of state that is trapped by a cluster of impurities. And such large size impurity states can also not be described in a single site theory.
Before you move on, I thought for this particular audience, it would be useful to point out the connection between CPA and the very popular these days dynamic and impurity theory. Because it would be useful to bring that into
Yeah, but I don't think I'm the right person to give a lecture about that connection. But they are related.
It's exactly the same as dynamic mean field theory, except that this is designed for non-interacting systems.
Right.
If the self-energy is produced not by impurity, rather by many body interaction, then you call it dynamic mean field theory. But it's exactly the same idea. Mm-hmm. But it's recaptured and the marketing.
Yeah,
yeah. New deal.
Well, CPA was invented first.
CPA was invented many years ago.
Yeah.
And now it's has a new name now.
But we learned from Suki that PMFT has many fathers now. Everyone claims to have invented
PMFT. Anyway, I have a new name here. It's supercell approximation. I guess it's not a new name. But, right, so I want to calculate this disordered system directly. And the way I do it is I just calculate a large number of large size configurations, each with periodic boundary conditions. And then to get the average green function of the disordered system, I simply average those configuration green functions. So that's a nice idea, but in practice it might be hard to do. So yeah, as I said, I developed two techniques to facilitate this kind of approach. The first is how do you plot the band structure of such a supercell? Wei and I developed some kind of unfolding technique for plotting band structures of supercells.
Sorry to interrupt, maybe a stupid question, but why do you need supercells? Can you go back to
Yeah.
So all these single cells in each of the configurations are the same, so why do you need a supercell for them?
No, the supercell, I just didn't want to, I guess, the supercell is just one of those. I mean,
okay, and then
I
don't, you unfold it or
vector. Right, I just didn't want to draw an infinite. Yeah, but it's just,
you
you're right.
Everything to the large cells.
Yeah, this figures a little bit.
Okay.
Right, so I developed these two techniques. And this is the construction of an effective Hamiltonian that will be efficient and needed to handle very big functions. Okay, but first is unfolding stuff. So I only show some formulas, and unfortunately I have to introduce some kind of notation. So I will have this convention that all the small letters are for the normal cell, and all the big letters are for the supercell. So the small k will be the crystal momentum of the normal cell, and the big k, the crystal momentum of the supercell.
And you don't have to remember this table, because I will keep it on each slide.
So here you see the same system. On the left-hand side, it's represented in these normal cell letters. And you see the corresponding band structure in the normal k-space, the normal cell k-space. And on the right-hand side, the same system is represented by a super lattice, supercell lattice, where each supercell is twice as big as the normal cell. And because of that, the supercell Brillouin zone will be twice as small, and the bands that lie outside of this supercell Brillouin zone will be folded backwards. So this is very typical in first principle calculations, that you end up with a Brillouin zone that is much smaller and contains twice as many bands. And then it becomes very hard to compare, for example, a calculation done on this normal cell k-space with this supercell k-space. And that's unfortunate. So what do we do? Rather than plotting just the eigenvalues, we're going to plot the spherical function. On the same basis, on the basis of this normal cell k-space. So that is just the imaginary part of this green function. And if I insert in this expression here a completeness of eigenstates, then this spectral function becomes a product of two factors. The Green's function on the eigenbasis multiplied times the spectral width. And the Green's function on the eigenbasis is very simple, and you can just directly obtain it from the eigenvalues, like this. And the spectral weight would normally involve some kind of continuous real space integration. But because we are using Wannier functions in a smart way, it will actually boil down to a finite small sum over the components of your eigenvector with this phase vector, and how that precisely works out, you can ask me afterwards. Anyway, so we use the, now both the eigenvalue and the eigenvector to plot our band structure. And how it will look like is like this. So this is the spectral function now of this supercell. And you will still have this original band and this folded band. But what you will find is that the spectral weight of this folded band will be zero. So then you're in a situation where you can nicely compare this normal cell band structure with the supercell one. Okay? So these were just cartoons.
So, yes. When you say that the folded band will have a zero weight, you mean that the supercell is an artificial one. It really is the same system as the reference cell.
Yes, that's right.
But you didn't tell us what if the supercell exists for a reason. If the symmetry is indeed broken.
Right. Suppose you put like some kind of impurity here, but it only weakly affects the band structure of this original lattice. Well, you will see exactly what will happen in the next examples that I will show you. But that's right. So the first example I will show you is of sodium dot cobaltate. So this sodium dot cobaltate basically is a system that has layers of triangular cobalt sandwiched between layers of triangular oxygen. The triangles are kind of hard to see in this normal cell, but you have to believe me. And so it's a double layer system. And now I'm gonna also, I want to study the band structure of this funny square root of 3 by square root of 3 supercell that contains three times as the amount of normal cells. So it's three times as big as this normal cell. And as Wei said, I'm now gonna put some sodiums in there that will break this potential. So because this supercell is three times as big, the Brillouin zone will be three times as small. And all the bands that lie outside of this supercell Brillouin zone, in other words, all the bands in this yellow region will be backfolded into this smaller Brillouin zone, and you will end up with three times as many bands, and you'll get a spaghetti. So here you can see what I'm talking about. So on the left-hand side, you see the band structure of the normal cell. And these colors, by the way, indicate the character of the bands. So all these colored bands here are the cobalt states, and all the gray ones are the oxygen ones. And here you see the band structure plotted with just using the eigenvalues from this supercell. And as I said, the K space is different, and you get three times as many bands, so these things are hard to compare. But daily practice and first principle calculation. And this is how it looks like when you just plot, when you're going to use both the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors to plot your spectral function. So the normal cell one just looks exactly the same. But yeah, the supercell one now really looks much more similar to the normal cell one. And you can start really, so what happened here is that all these backfolded bands are still here, but almost all of them totally disappeared from your picture because their spectral weight is zero. Except at some very small places where you see some gap openings. So let me focus a little bit on that. Here I just focus on one gap opening. You can indeed see that near a gap opening, those folded bands still have some finite spectral weight because they're hybridizing precisely by this periodic potential of the sodiums. Okay? So now I will show some more unfolded band structures for copper dot zinc oxide.
Could you just go back a couple of slides where you have the two band structures? Yeah. And maybe
this one or this
yeah.
One?
Yes, that one. Maybe it's just my eyesight, but it looks to me as though the bands on the left are a little bit sort of fuzzy, as well as yeah.
This one, that's right. Yes.
Why is that?
Because that's just artificial, but we put in some exploiting utility, we put in some finite width just to make it more visible.
So really, they should be absolutely sharp on the left.
Yeah, I don't want to plot the delta function.
Fuzzy on the right.
Yeah. This fuzziness is artificial.
Actually, on the right, you don't see fuzziness either. You see some splitting.
Okay.
Effectively, you produce and see that the characteristic way by hand, right? By enlarging the periodicity. And all these gaps you see opening are the CW gap.
But Rakshuman, there's fuzziness here, right?
Yes, I mean, I was expecting, and as Wade points out, wrongly, really, that you'd actually see fuzziness arising from the non-periodicity on the right.
Yes, yes.
But I was confused by the fact that there was fuzziness already on
These delta functions are a little bit smeared out just to make it visible, that's all.
Both sides are delta functions.
But they should be smeared out in the infinite case.
If I have an infinite supersymmetry?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you really have a configuration average.
Right, well, we get there.
This is just one,
I know,
calculation. It's not disordered, right? It's perfectly ordered.
I know, but I'm just anticipating. Yeah,
I'm
sure.
Yes,
it's okay. We'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get. But you want the physical smear. You don't want the artificial
smear. Okay, so first thing we'll try. So I did this calculation with LDA plus U, and I'm just showing the spin majority. So what I'm going to show you here is four slides in which I start from zinc oxide, so 0% copper, and then go all the way to 100% copper. I will go over it a few times. So this is 100% copper. And what is, you can see that these supercells are totally different in geometry, but now with the spectral technique, we can all plot them on the same basis, which is really nice, I think. So for example, you can start focusing, this is for example a zinc band, and you can really see how from 0% to 100% the band structure continuously deforms from one to the other. So if I, for example, put 12.5% copper in here, you still see that the zinc band is very present, and very weak copper band starts appearing here at the Fermi surface. And then zinc band is still present, copper band becomes stronger, and then the zinc band is totally gone, and this copper band is 100% now. Okay, that was the unfolding, and now the other technique, the effective Hamiltonian that I'm going to need if I really want to do big supercells. Right, so the concept I call linearity is to drop correlations of influences of impurities on the Hamiltonian. And if you do that, then the influence of an impurity becomes additive. So this is the same thing with the formula. I'm gonna keep the linear influence of the impurities and drop correlations. And one of the reasons why I think this adding will work, the linearity will work, is because the external potential is added. So that's one of the reasons why I think this will work. Now I will explain explicitly how I construct the effective Hamiltonian in three steps. So first, I perform two DFT calculations, one without any dopants in them, so I can just use the normal cell, and one with a single impurity, for which I have to use a supercell. Now, this supercell has nothing to do with the supercell approximation I'm going to talk about later. This is just like in a phonon calculation. You want to partition this impurity from its super images that are sitting right here. So you have to choose a reasonably big supercell, like something like 2x2. That circle is the influence of this impurity on the all those hopping elements and on-site energies that I want to capture. So then once these two small DFT calculations are converged, I'm going to perform on both of them 1-year transformations, and then I'm going to obtain two tight binding Hamiltonians, which I will denote H0 and H1, where H0 is the one without any dopant in them, and H1 with simply one impurity. And this is where the efficiency of my method will come from, because I'm only going to capture this low-energy Hilbert space, and I'm going to remove all these very high bands, unoccupied bands, and these very deep occupied bands. Okay, so I have two tight-binding Hamiltonians. And then to construct the effective Hamiltonian of an arbitrary configurations, I'm simply going to use linear superposition. So, as I said, to capture the influence of a single impurity, I will just subtract the two. And then to construct the effective Hamiltonian of n impurities, I will just add this difference delta n times to the undoped tight binding Hamiltonian.
So that sounds simple, at least.
One of the problems technically is that I have to somehow partition this influence of this impurity from its superimage. That's a little bit tricky. So as I said, all of this relies on two assumptions. First of all, that indeed the influence can be is additive, and this I want to test, and also I want to test whether or not I did a good job with the partition. So what I'm going to show in the next slide is a comparison between some calculations from an effective Hamiltonian with a calculation from the full DFT. And then I'm going to plot the band structures for both and compare them and see how well this effective method is doing. And I'm going to choose my systems in such a way that they test either of those or both. So, for example, to study sodium doped cobaltate, I'm going to use this normal cell with no sodiums in it, and I'm going to use this 2x2 supercell, which contains one sodium. And as a test case, I'm going to use linear superposition on those to construct the effective Hamiltonian of this this funny square root of 3 supercell that I showed you before. And this actually will test this linearity principle, because I'm going to extrapolate from 12% sodium all the way to 66% sodium. And also, this will test if I did a good job with the partitioning. Basically, because this configuration here strongly breaks the translational symmetry of this Hamiltonian here.
So now I'll show the results.
So on the left-hand side, I'm showing the spectral function of the full DFT population, and on the right-hand side, I'm showing the spectral function of the effective Hamiltonian. And first, I noticed that all these bands, the shift of the bands, is accurately reproduced by the effective Hamiltonian. And also, at many places, these gap openings are reproduced nicely. So I just focus here on one of them. So all these details here seem to be captured by this effective Hamiltonian. But this full DFT calculation was performed on the basis of more than 2,000 LAPWs. And this effective Hamiltonian was done on the basis of 66 1A functions. And this involved self-consistency. And this was done in one shot, in one diagonalization.
Let's see, I'm confused. With an effective Hamiltonian, are you restricting? You don't get the smearing that you would get with the full problem. It's kind of natural smearing for the configuration.
At this level, it's still, as Wei said, a small periodic population, so I don't expect any smearing just yet. But later on, I'm going to...
There's no disorder at all, just a crystal with a larger unit cell, but that was confusing me earlier.
I can say right away what's going to happen if I'm going to do very big cells.
But he has an X.
Like X of doping?
Yeah, but he has one X with one particular supercell.
But I want to say it straight away, actually, now that we are... So all these gap openings here, that you see here, if I'm now going to do a very big cell, then you have tiny gap openings everywhere. And these kind of gap openings, that will be the fussiness that you are after. So you'll see it later.
Okay.
So now I want to show the most shocking slides of my presentation. I find it shocking. I'm gonna use again two small DFT calculations and predict still a small configuration. But what I find so amazing is that I start from 25% copper impurities and extrapolate all the way to 100%. And I want to remind you that these band structures are really different. So, I mean, maybe there's a trivial reason for all of this, but I still find it shocking. So, so this is, again, the comparison. So I just don't see any difference between the full DFT calculation and the effective Hamiltonian. I mean, if you really look carefully, you see some small differences here. But for practical purposes, this effective Hamiltonian, for this case, does a perfect job. And as I said, there might be a very trivial reason for that, but I still find it amazing. And I can also extrapolate the other way around. So from 25%, I can go, for example, to 12.5%. And once again, compare my effective Hamiltonian results with the full DFT. And you can see that the effective Hamiltonian is doing a good job.
Are the results better in that case than the full extrapolation to 100% copper?
No. It seems all good, I think. I'm actually a little bit cheating because I'm showing this rock salt compound for which it worked most beautifully, but that's just because I wanted to make it more exciting. Sometimes it doesn't always work so great. Yeah, like for example here, and I was cheating again because I only showed place where I did a very good job. For example, here, the DFT has some kind of structure here that is not captured by my effective Hamiltonian, or the other way around. My effective Hamiltonian has some gap opening here that is not in here. So it's not always good, it's still reasonable. Okay, so now the end of my talk, almost. I just want to show you some results with this order now.
For sodium, we need to look at every configuration now?
Right. For sodium dot potentate and copper dot zeros. So, yeah, well, I remind you, I just, I'm going to calculate now big supercells with approximately hundreds of atoms. And then calculate their Green's functions and average these configuration Green functions to obtain my Green's function from the disordered system. So this is the physical question that I was after in sodium cobaltate. So there's a big controversy between theory and experiment. So the theoretical predicted Fermi surface consists of one big AG hole pocket surrounded by six elliptical AG prime hole pockets. But when the measurement was done, they only found this big AG pocket and not the six small EG prime pockets. So, I mean, there are many papers have been written on this issue, mostly focusing on the effect of correlation. But David Singh had this interesting idea that maybe the sodiums being disordered could destroy these EG prime pockets. So this was the question we're trying to answer. So what I did is I calculated 30 configurations, each of about 200 atoms, and calculated all their Green's functions and averaged those spectral functions. and...
Where do they come from?
Which one?
The configuration.
Oh, from a random number generator.
So you assume that every configuration is equally...
Yes, that's what we assume, except, well, we're following David Singh's idea that we just allow everything except for sodiums to be sitting right next to each other. Yeah. We could also, of course, do something more sophisticated, like, for example, doing some kind of thermal ensemble in there. But I'm still not able to calculate total energy with my method. So for now, I'll just do this.
How do you know how big your units are to be in the Fermion group?
I just do the stupid thing of cranking it up to the point that I see the result is converged. So I converge with respect to the size of my cells, and I converge with respect to the number of configurations. And if I see that the result is the spectral function. I mean, this is not very, I just look with my eye. And if I see that everything more or less is stable, I'm happy.
This is called self-averaging.
Yeah, one thing that's important to point here is that he has different shape of this. So the artificial CW there, for each of the configuration, you generate a charge-density wave with a runtime P with a Q, right? That would be washed out because you now have different Q in your very different configuration. That's very, very important. Initially, we didn't do this, and we just use a fixed shape, then we just put different randomness in it. And we find out the charge energy can then disappear because the artificial periodicity is in every configuration. So that's totally artificial. So we have to average all
the time. So you wash out this artificial periodicity by choosing different things.
Right. So basically, now we have a code that generates configuration automatically, including the shape of the superset. So that you can wash out the artificial.
Now, we basically don't average just with impurity position, we also average with
different shapes, supercell size. Right?
Just how do you know which one to choose?
No, it's all
random.
Random.
Very good, random. Yeah. 30 is a good number. If you are...
I mean, good enough. I mean, I just looked at the results and the result didn't change anymore. So I did 15 first, then 15, and then average them separately, and then see, okay, this. These look the same. Okay, so anyway, this is the status that I was talking about. So what we found is that some of these states get affected very much by the sodium impurities, especially those oxygen states below here. And if I just go back for a moment. That is actually very understandable because these oxygens are the closest one to the sodium. So the green things are the sodiums and the blue ones are the oxygens. So yeah, the sodium states get affected most, and some of them pick up this big lifetime of about 1 dB. Oh yeah, by the way, this is a spectral function for a fixed K. This is not density of state, or it's like density of states for a particular K. And then, yeah, these colored bands, these are the cobalt bands, they're getting affected much less by the sodium disorder. So among those cobalt bands, we found that these AG states are affected more by the sodium disorder than the EG prime states. You can see that, for example, in here, this AG state becomes fuzzy a little bit and picks up a lifetime of about 20 mDV. But throughout all of this, the EG prime states remain totally perfectly coherent. So we conclude that everything gets affected by the disorder except the EG prime states. So yeah. Okay. And now this property of zinc oxide. So our experimental collaborators noticed something very strange. They did a whole bunch of measurements. I'm just showing the squid here. But what they noticed is that whenever they grew their sample under oxygen-rich conditions, nothing really much happened. That's this blue line here. But when they grew their zinc oxide copper dot sample under oxygen-poor conditions, all of a sudden they picked up this big room temperature magnetism. So obviously, the question was then, what is the role of this oxygen vacancy? To do this calculation, I just went ahead with my method. In this case, I just did that 10. Maybe I should have done more, but we were running out of time. So each of about 200 atoms. And I chose 2% copper and 1% oxygen vacancy, approximately, consistent with the experiment. And I also chose this magnetism of 0.8 for copper. And I obtained these spectral functions. So the most interesting part of the spectral function are these two impurity states here. So this is the copper D state, and this is the oxygen vacancy state. And by the way, I enhanced the intensity of this copper D state by a factor of 40, just to make it more visible. So now this oxygen vacancy state looks much less than this copper D, but that's just artificial. So you see that this copper D state extends throughout the whole Brillouin zone. And what that means is that if you put the Fourier transformation to real space, that this copper D state only lives in one cell. So it's very localized. But you also see that this oxygen vacancy state has only intensity in a very small part of the Brillouin zone. For example, if you go into this direction of gamma to M, you see that it only goes roughly to one-fifth of that part of the Brillouin zone. And roughly what that means in real space is that this oxygen vacancy state is very big. So that means that it will probably extend to about 5 cells before it dies up. And then we propose this simple picture to explain the experiment, namely that these oxygen vacancy states are very big and therefore can mediate the copper moment. So here's a cartoon. By the way, this was very counterintuitive for the experimenters that oxygen vacancy state would make the sample magnetic, because what oxygen vacancy does is it donates 2 electrons. So you would expect that whatever kind of magnetism you would have would yet be killed by oxygen vacancies, because they are going to put electrons in those copper states and make them inactive. But the point is, so here is the situation with no vacancies, and there are lots of moments, but they don't talk to each other because they're all so small in size. And then when you add these oxygen vacancies, indeed, a lot of these magnetic moments now become inert because they get filled up with these electrons from the oxygen vacancy. But those that remain will now be connected by this oxygen vacancy state, and they can align their spin. So that was the picture that we obtained from this first principle.
And that's it.
Now, at the moment, I'm working on 2 new materials. Calcium intercalated graphene. I want to see what is the effect of disordered calciums on the Fermi surface. And Chi Teng Li, the postdoc, is going to apply my method to this iron chalcogenide and see the effect of disorder. And Phil Allen is not here, but I want to work with him and his student Lily to study this solid solution that they have been working on for quite some time now. And there's also other kinds of things I want to do. What I'm really interested in, and I think this method is perfect for that, is to study now the effect of short-range order. Instead of putting them randomly, I can now maybe put some short-range order in there. That's of course can be studied with this direct method. Since I have access to the full Hamiltonian, I don't need to just calculate single particle range functions. I guess I can do any particle range function I want. And there's lots of stuff that needs to be done. I need to extend my method to calculate total energy. Maybe I can improve my method by incorporating more impurity correlations. That means that I'm going to have to do 3 DFT calculations, but perhaps I get better quality, etc., etc. Okay, so this is the summary of my talk.
Is there any relationship between your model Hamiltonian and the cluster expansion?
The cluster expansion, do you mean that method that calculates total energy by that?
Yeah. I mean, the idea is similar.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the idea is very similar, except for the fact that this cluster method only calculates total energy, and my method calculates the entire Hamiltonian. So at the end of the day, if you do a cluster expansion, you only have access to total energy.
Well, in principle, when you link it to a Monte Carlo simulation, then you have also access to the low densities of data. So depending on
your. Okay. Maybe I'm not familiar enough with this cluster expansion method, but the idea is very simple.
Just formula.
Yes. Very similar to this.
You split it up in different figures in this cluster expansion.
Right, like this or something. They're doing something like this, but then an expansion in total energy.
Right.
Yeah.
They're with different spins. Just an expansion with various coefficients.
Right. But it's, yeah. I guess it's a little harder to expand the entire Hamiltonian rather than just one variable, like total energy.
But
once again, I'm not familiar enough. Exactly.
So the sodium cobalt oxide system there,
yeah.
What's the physical reason why the disorder doesn't affect these? Was it EG prime?
Right. The reason I've also been asking myself that, I have here some Fourier function that makes it clearer. So these oxygens, first of all, are very close to the sodium. So that they obviously are more effective than the cobalt state. But so this cobalt state here is pointing directly towards the sodium. So you can imagine that it is affected more by the sodium. And this EG state here is pointing towards the oxygen, and the oxygen is in which all the action is happening. But this, so you can imagine that this state is also affected by this disorder. But this state is pointing away from all the action, away from the sodium and away from the oxygen. So that's what I think is the reason.
Wasn't it led by the same to think that it would be affected?
Well, he did some kind of analysis that I don't really understand. Yeah.
He's the out of this generation. He's an LDA believer. He wanted to make the best case of LDA can make. So he justified by looking at the core level. He's seeing that the core level changes energy when you get close to the impurity. So that's the indication of the disorder. And he ignored all the species dependent, orbital dependence. He says, well, if core level is moving up and down, everything should be moving up and down. Therefore, you're going to see a big disorder. That's his idea. But the qualitative factor.
I would think that the idea is not so strange, because if disorder, if you forget about orbital dependence, but I think if you look at my disorder as well. So disorder, I think, is typically going to show up most at the edge of a band. It's not a crazy idea if you have a Fermi surface that exactly consists of a small pocket. In general, you would expect this pocket might be very sensitive to the effect of disorder, but apparently not for this EG prime state.
But I mean, even without having the precise Fourier function, just consideration of the symmetry of the orbit, it should have.
Yeah, you could have argued this, yes.
The orbit is just not pointing towards where the disorder is.
Right. But
Davy seems to be the god in this particular field, right? So whatever he said, everybody believed.
There are lots of other sources of disorder besides the kind you're talking about.
Impurities, vacancies, and
vibrations, distortions, etc.
Right. I'm not really sure how my method would work.
Well, the question is, how much do they affect what's really seen compared to what you have? I mean, I can see there are some differences in the two of them.
Right.
Between.
I mean, I don't know, I guess big difference. I mean, that must, yeah, it depends, I guess. If somehow for whatever kind of physical quantity you're probing, at least locally, it looks regular, like a regular crystal with a few defects, I guess then this will be good enough. But
yeah, but maybe you can combine this with some others. Maybe by adding the cell phone, adding spectrum or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah, I've heard this QMM talks now for the first time in my life here. So maybe for the QM part you could do this, and then for the MM part.
Yeah, sure. This secret assurance actually is good to make some tradition with some of the other things people are doing. So if you like to think about self-identity, because this is now a quasi particle with a well-defined self-identity. It's not a GW self-identity, but it's a disorder in your self. You can see that there is, first of all, strong orbital dependence, but more importantly, you see strong treatment, right? For example, you see the same oxygen band sometimes become very fuzzy, sometimes dark. Mm. Even the red, the pink, AG band, which at some point, K point, become very fuzzy, but in some other K point, down.
Here.
Right? So it's telling you that this is strongly orbital dependent, and more importantly, it's also treatment. And that is the fundamental problem with all the mean field theory, including the Dynamical mean field theory, as well as the CPA. Mm-hmm. Right? Because there you assume the self-energy is always local, it's energy over k-space, but these kind of things will never be captured.
Right?
And in addition to that, if you look at the next one, the one showing the oxygen vacancy. So in some sense, this tells you short-range fluctuation or short-range correlation is actually very important. Self-energy is not just local. It actually spread out as it should be. And you can actually see it in the spatial function.
Right.
And here in this example, it's even more amazing that you see the impurity of the size of what a 5 microscope. This is Anderson localization. This is the miracle of Anderson localization, that the coherence happened because of this order. You don't need any interaction in the system, just localized.
Right.
This is a miracle. And you can see that from this big calculation at this big size. If you do any mean field, like CPA,
right,
you watch them out immediately.
Right. Right.
So it's telling you that the finite size short-range correlations are very, very important in real material.
And natural, by design.
Right. Even for weakly correlated system, this
right.
is important.
Yeah.
Right. So then you can imagine that if you go to strongly correlated system, this becomes even more of an issue. Long-range, large-sized object, you can go all the way to mesoscopic size in principle, become a real physics dominant object, which we cannot access to because we are limited to smaller unit cell. But this is what happened with this calculation, that we can start to dream to go beyond a few small number of units and start thinking about bigger objects. Another probably interesting to mention here is you notice that there's this upper Hubbard band and lower Hubbard band, the copper D, the pink one. One is at the majority, one is in the minority. They have different energy. One is at 0 eV, the other is about minus 6 eV. You see these two main features, right? The upper and lower Hubbard band. You see that they don't have to be fully spin polarized. If you do a mean field calculation in LDA plus U with one atom per unit cell, then of course you will find that it's fully polarized.
So you have a unit with LDA plus U with this calculation? Oh, okay, I think you never said actually.
Right. So this is based on LDA plus U calculation. So you see that they don't have to be fully spin polarized. In fact, you can go to a case when they become so-called paramagnetic, but there's a random. Then in that case, the upper and lower Hubbard will still be in the same energy, but their spatial work will be exactly the same for up and down. But this is the well-known solution by MMT, and they solved the paramagnetic phase. They always say that LDA or DMT cannot give you a paramagnetic phase, because if it's non-magnetic, all your demand collapse at the Fermi level and become atomic rather than insulated. That's the claim of fame of DMT, that you can always see an insulating paramagnetic phase. You can see here that, in fact, LDA plus U is capable of doing exactly the same thing if you had the right ensemble. But there is no fundamental difficulty with DMT on its own to produce a paramagnetic insulating phase. It is all possible. You can get a Mach phase if you want. It's all possible. You just need to put it into the right fluctuation.
Anything else you want to add, Wei?
Oh, by the way, we didn't mention this, one more impurity state at the minus 9 eV,
right?
Right. Yeah, that's a pure localized state.
Yeah.
So even zinc.
So this oxygen vacancy, it actually came originally out of this, it's pooled out of this S band. and this zinc thing, yeah, this is also, you could call this an oxygen vacancy. It's also comes originally out of this zinc D band. But these are the zinc D bands that are sitting very close to the oxygen, so they feel some kind of attractive potential.
So would that be present in all the configurations, or just some of them? That last state.
All of these states will be present in all of the configurations.
They'll always be there near the impurity. The question is whether they localize or they form a band and start to move around.
Okay, we still have 20 minutes until the coffee and cookies, but the same thing. Despite being unfocused, we haven't been able to do this week.